I am investor and co-owner of Resource Stock Digest and Digest Publishing, Nick Hodge. I am here without my co-host, friend and co-owner in those businesses, Mr. Gerardo Del Real. He is in Costa Rica with his lovely wife celebrating their anniversary, as folks do in the middle of summer. And instead, I have with me, as I did 2 months ago, Mr. Chris Curl, your editor of Digital Dispatch and Chris Curl's Crypto Cycle. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Nick, doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. We're going to stick to the typical Bizarro World format here. We'll talk a little bit about the macro. I'll run down some of the events of the week and some of the key callouts, and then we'll get into topics that are nearer and dearer to your heart, including the technology sector and the crypto sector. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Both of us are coming to you live, at least if you're listening to the paid version of this, from Spokane, which has been in the news this week on multiple fronts, because we are the home of one Ryan Sandberg and one Ms. Sydney Sweeney, both of which have been in the headlines this week for different reasons. Maybe we'll get to some of that later in the podcast. To start with the macro musings, though, we had a Fed meeting this week, and so we must talk about that. So that, of course, we are obligated to as financial commentators. And it was a nothing burger. It was what most market observers knew it was going to be. It was going to be no rate cut. And perhaps more importantly, now you're below a 50% chance of a rate cut at the next Fed meeting in September. There's been an ongoing dog and pony show between your president and your Federal Reserve chairman, only one of whom is elected, by the way. The president, of course, wants lower interest rates, and so does his Treasury Secretary, and so does his housing director, Bill Pult, who's been very vocal about it. And they even took to the Federal Reserve's new building, which is running vastly over budget, to have another episode of that dog and pony show. So, you know, Mr. Trump could chastise Mr. Powell while they were wearing hard hats. But at the end of the day, a lot of that is just, as I say, bizarre world fodder or dog and pony show stuff. At the end of the day, inflation's still running hot. June ticked up higher than May. You got no rate cut. The Fed is still data dependent, and less than a 50% chance of a rate cut in September. What did that do? Well, for our intents and purposes, it sent gold nosediving down below $3,300. Gold, of course, wants the tailwind of lower rates, but I believe that's a temporary reaction. That's only one of the things that's been driving gold. There's still plenty of other drivers, from geopolitics to international warfare to, you know, record levels of U.S. debt and trade uncertainty. So gold firmly at 3,300 seems like it wants to settle in around there, and, you know, could go sideways for a bit. And that would be okay for the Newmonts, the Barricks, the Agnicos of the world, who, by the way, are reporting earnings this week and continue to crush it. So that's your gold update. A little bit on copper, which also got crushed because of quasi-political things that happened this week. To wit, earlier this month, you'll recall that Mr. Trump declared a 50% tariff on copper. That was the first week of this month while I was down in Boca at the Rick Rule Conference. And then subsequently to that, the U.S. copper price went to nearly $6 on the COMEX, nearly all-time record high prices, separating itself from prices in Europe. Equity started to run. I've discussed Freeport McMoRan on this podcast in recent weeks. I've told you that I own it. And then yesterday, Trump came out and said that that 50% tariff will not be applied for refined copper products, which sort of defeats the entire purpose of a copper tariff, because it is in fact refined copper products that this country imports. And so the tariff back and forth continues. Trump is tacoing, as we've come to call it now, chickening out from the copper tariff. And that sent copper down more than a buck, from nearly $6 to below $5 a pound. And it sent copper companies down sharply, including FCX or Freeport, which I just mentioned. I was writing today in the weekly issue of Hodge Family Office that both those events, the Fed meeting and the unwinding of the copper tariff, are especially the unwinding of the copper tariff, are temporary. The long-term forecasted structural deficits for copper aren't going anywhere. The fact that America doesn't produce or refine enough copper, that's not going anywhere. The energy transition is not going anywhere, nor is the advent of AI and the building out of data centers and transmission lines that are going to require all of that copper. So buying opportunity in copper stocks is how I frame that up. And if you stick around long enough, maybe we'll talk about some of those names in the premium portfolio picks of this podcast. And with that, Mr. Curl, a little bit of brief macro out of the way, I want to pivot to a topic that you wanted to discuss at the top of the hour here, namely recent trade wins, specifically with the EU. So maybe you can enlighten me, because there's been so much going on with the trade, as I said, back and forth, that it's been tough to keep up. So what are you seeing out there that the U.S. is winning on?
Well, I mean, it's hard to frame everything in stark terms of winning and losing, although that's, of course, how Trump likes to see things. But this all kind of goes back to, I believe I was on Bizarro World right after the Liberation Day, when the markets were reeling and everybody was warning that an impending depression was coming, and that the sky was falling. And you and I were both sitting here saying, listen, like, this isn't going to lead to a depression. This is just Trump's art of the deal negotiating tactics, however wrongheaded they were. You know, he hits you with an outrageous term, like these insane tariff numbers that he had, and then destabilizes you, or at least thinks he's going to destabilize you, and you'll come back to the negotiating table from a weakened position where he can then take advantage. Now, maybe that worked on countries that were very vulnerable, like Vietnam, et cetera. Countries like China, obviously, are much stronger and not really willing to play ball in that way. But what just happened this week was, I think, Trump can consider a pretty big win over the EU, where the even EU leaders were really admitting that this was kind of a major capitulation for them. This is being called by Trump as the biggest deal ever made in trade. I don't know if that's true, but he's going to sell it.
Huge,
he's going to sell it. Yeah, that's right. But, you know, it's a 15% baseline tariff on EU goods, and that's down from the 30%. The EU is going to purchase $750 billion in U.S. energy. That's oil, that's liquid natural gas, that's nuclear fuel or uranium, if you will, over the next 3 years. So Trump's trying to position the U.S. as the main supplier of energy to Europe to replace Russia, who has, of course, been supplying them with cheap natural gas for a long time. That obviously is not happening like it was. And of course, it also includes that $600 billion in European corporate investments that have been pledged to the U.S. By 2029. Again, I don't know how that will be enforced, but it's a good soundbite for Trump, and he can use it to rally his base. Big part of it is the zero tariffs on U.S. autos, aircraft parts, semiconductors, and agricultural exports to the EU. So that was pretty big, because even if you think all this trade stuff is silly, getting rid of the uncertainty is good for the markets. The markets hate uncertainty, and having a clear deal made, having a framework there, allows the markets to digest that information and then figure out, hey, what sectors are going to really perform well in the coming years, which is pretty clear that energy is going to be a big one. And I know you and Gerardo talk about that a lot. Like all of the major benefit, the big energy companies, Exxon, Chevron, any kind of biofuels are going to get a big boost. all of these liquid natural gas deals he's making, I don't think we have enough liquid natural gas to export to all these countries to fulfill the contractual obligations. But liquefied natural gas is going to be big because the demand for that is going to be extremely high. With all, I think he made a similar deal with Japan, and there's deals with South Korea and other countries.
South Korea, yep.
So demand for liquefied natural gas is going to be massive. This gets rid of major EU tariff barriers on U.S. agriculture. I don't know if Europe is really excited about eating our Roundup Ready wheat, but they're going to get it. And they're going to get particularly almond, pork, and dairy exports, which are going to explode. So that's pretty big for the agricultural industry. I mean, I think it's hopefully going to help the U.S. manufacturing, at least in aerospace, and maybe auto manufacturing, because I know Europe had some stiff tariffs on imported autos from the U.S. that, you know, that we might see more of a U.S. auto market in Europe come from that as well. And I think geopolitically, this was really an attempt to weaken reliance on Russian energy and the power that Russia has over the EU, and strengthen that U.S. geopolitical leverage over Europe, and maybe take some of the trade away from China. We'll see how that plays out, but essentially trying to weaken the BRICS countries, the countries that are trying to move away from U.S. dollar hegemony and power and create their own system. This is an attempt to keep the EU tightly trading and, frankly, somewhat controlled by the United States like they have been since the end of the Second World War. And I think, I'm not a trade expert, but I think that you can look at this deal as a win for the United States, at least in the short term. I don't know if trade partners like Germany feeling like they're constantly being bullied by the United States is a good long-term strategy, but for now, they're more or less capitulating and kind of going along with what the United States wants. So we'll see. I take it as a win specifically for the sectors that I mentioned for right now, at any rate.
Well, Germany made its own bed in some respects. They turned off their nukes and had to fire back up their coal plants and made themselves vulnerable to energy security issues that they still need to find the chutzpah to rectify on their own time. So, and let me take it from a top-down perspective on some of the things you said there. So the last time you were on the show was in very early May. It was when Bitcoin just got back to $100,000. I assume that's why we had you on the show in early May. We'll get to that in a second. And you're right. We were saying that recession is not on the horizon. We are coming out of this the market crash. You'll recall the S&P went down significantly in April on the back of that Liberation Day that you were just mentioning. And I was saying, no, like there's going to be positive GDP growth, and it might be a little bit of a rough summer, but I'll be using that to position for the second half of the year, which I think is going to be positive for U.S. equities and indexes. And that's precisely what we've seen. So as you did a great job of explaining sort of the calming of that trade uncertainty, you know, what's been happening in the market? So all you got to do is look, we've been hitting all-time record highs in the S&P and particularly in the NASDAQ, which has been on fire. Volatility, as evidenced by the VIX, has really calmed down, and we are in a bull market for equities with no sign of recession on the horizon. We just printed 3% GDP growth, I think was the number worth mentioning, because we just got the first print for Q2, right? So and then drilling down on some of the other stuff you said, particularly in Europe, and I wanted to bring in a question we had, so I didn't put this on the sheet that we used to get through the podcast, but in my inbox I did have a question from a reader. I don't have the name in front of me, so excuse me for that, but it was essentially talking about a company I've been writing about that's recycling magnets, that has a magnet recycling technology to take the rare earths out and make hard drives. And the gentleman was wondering if there's any other similar plays like that in Europe. And there are a few. I'll give you a couple of freebies before we get into the next section of the podcast. One company we've talked about a little bit on this podcast that I know Gerardo has followed for a long time is Leading Edge Materials. And they've got both a graphite deposit and infrastructure, a past producing graphite deposit, and a rare earth asset. So Leading Edge Materials is one place to look. And then there's another company called Neo Performance Materials that's also making rare earths in Europe with factories in Estonia, I believe it is. And so when you talk about the, you know, Europe needing to secure their supply of these rare minerals or break sort of the trade monopoly with China, that's why that question popped into my mind. And I don't know how much natural gas we have to export, but I do know that the U.S. energy sector is going to be is bullish. It's going mm-hmm. to be bullish. And I've been making recommendations there as well, particularly in, and this is funny, the Gulf of America. There's a Gulf of America company that's operating pipelines. So just touching on some of the things you said there about Europe and the trade deal. But I do want to get into crypto because that's why you're here. So let's make the turn to the market take section here. And I'll reiterate that Bitcoin just went to record high prices. I think $122,000. Correct me if I'm wrong, Chris. Mm-hmm. And other equities have been bullish, things like Coinbase, etc. So I guess first, before we get into Project Crypto, tell me why. We had you on 2 months ago. Bitcoin was at 100,000. Why did it go to 120,000 in such short order?
Well, it was all of the reasons that I had highlighted in the last two, my last two appearances here on Crypto Cycle. Going all the way back to the tariff terror when all the cryptos were dumping, I was telling you the cycle is not over for a myriad of reasons. One being the fact that there would be a resolution to this trade uncertainty. There would be continued upside in the equity markets. And considering that crypto is somewhat correlated to the equity markets overall, that would go along up along with it. And combined with that, we also have the reality of the Bitcoin halving dynamics, where every single Bitcoin bull market we've ever had, we've seen Bitcoin top out 80 weeks after the Bitcoin halving. Bitcoin halving was in April of 2024. That would put us around October. There were a myriad of technical indicators marking a top for the market cycle, none of which had been hit. And one of the biggest technical indicators was the M2, which has been exploding. Bitcoin generally tends to follow that with about a 2 or 3 month lag, and we're seeing that play out exactly as I predicted as well. On top of that, we have, due to institutional demand for Bitcoin, a massive supply gap where you're seeing MicroStrategy alone has had a larger appetite for Bitcoin than the entire Bitcoin mining industry can produce. So there's just a supply-demand dynamic that's been playing out over the last 6 months where you're seeing more Bitcoin demand than the supply could possibly meet. And I think Bitcoin would probably be at $140,000 right now were it not for Mike Novogratz and Galaxy Digital selling 80,000 Bitcoin last week, which kind of sent the market reeling a bit. The fact that we didn't actually have a full market crash from that, though, is a testament to how incredibly strong this Bitcoin bull market is at this point. And that Bitcoin was from a Satoshi-era wallet. So this was somebody who basically probably had an initial investment of maybe $10,000, maybe somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000. And cashing it out for, I believe it was $8 to $9 billion. So that's a pretty good return.
For you. It's eight. Yep.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good return on investment for, whoever was behind that wallet. I mean, I guess they were, using Galaxy Digital to custody their funds, but pretty tremendous return. I don't blame them for selling there. Over 120, I think, is getting into getting into a sell zone for Bitcoin for the purposes of this market cycle. But yeah, I do still think we're going considerably higher towards the end of year into Q4 for Bitcoin, for the altcoins, and for a lot of equities as well.
Speaking of other coins, I often have said and have been for many years a Bitcoin maxi. I only owned Bitcoin when it came to cryptos. I didn't mess around with anything else. You, of course, have the Crypto Cycle portfolio that has some of my capital, and then you've been buying other things. But I tried to, back in May when Bitcoin was going back up to six figures, I tried to get back into Bitcoin in one of my letters, and I missed it. And it was clear to me, though, that even though I missed the price I wanted on that Bitcoin ETF, I think it was HODL, H-O-D-L is the one I typically buy. But it was clear to me that the entire complex was getting bullish, and I decided to buy ETHA instead, E-T-H-A, which is an Ethereum ETF. And that was in late May or early June, and here we are in the last day of July as we sit here, the 31st, and I'm up 60% on ETHA. So why, and maybe it's just altcoin season, maybe I'm overthinking it, but why is the entire complex bullish, and why is Ethereum, I guess, specifically moving? Yeah. 60% in a month or two.
Well, yeah, I mean, welcome to crypto. But yeah. So I was, as you can rewind the tape, I mean, I was telling people that Ethereum was massively oversold when it was under $2,000 earlier in the year. I was telling everybody to buy it because you simply do not get a crypto bull market without Ethereum leading the way for altcoins. And we're seeing that play out now. Bitcoin hits new all-time high, and Ethereum, which is the primary layer one, it's what all of the major institutional stuff is getting built on Ethereum. I know it's not as exciting as Solana and some of these other smaller layer ones, but it always leads the altcoin cycle. And it was massively oversold earlier in the year. It was a bit of a laggard compared to most of the other cryptocurrencies. And it was overdue for a massive rally. And I do not think that rally is over. I do think Ethereum is going to hit all-time highs later this year. And that will be the major catalyst for an alt season, because we've really never gotten a true alt season in this cycle yet. And I think the alt season will come very fast. It will come very heavy. And it will be likely towards the end of the year, maybe in the fall. October, November would be my best guess. But yeah, so much is being built on Ethereum. I could get into it today. It's very topical because today we just had the launch of Project Crypto, which is launched by the new SEC chairman, Paul Atkins, who's obviously very crypto-friendly, which aims to modernize securities laws. And really his big goal is to facilitate on-chain financial markets. That means everything's moving onto the blockchain, whether you like it or not. And that involves all of the equity markets. It involves fractional tokenized shares of real estate, of any valuable asset, fine art, anything, you name it. And this is happening on the Ethereum blockchain. So to be bearish on Ethereum doesn't make any sense. I've never been bearish on Ethereum. And it's going much higher. And that's not even to mention the growth of stable coins. A couple of weeks ago, we had Crypto Week in the White House, which proposed three new bills. You had the Anti-CBDC Act, which basically prevents the Fed from issuing a central bank digital currency, which is, I think, a great thing because that's a very powerful tool of control and something that works against financial and individual privacy. You had the Clarity Act, which gives some very, very much needed regulatory clarity to the crypto sphere, because under Gary Gensler, it was just labeling everything an unregistered security. Obviously, as you know, Nick, if you're going to issue a security, you go through a pretty lengthy process with the SEC to register everything. So none of these cryptocurrencies have registered with the SEC as a security. So Gary Gensler would
Fartcoin's not registered?
Believe it or not, no. So Gary Gensler would just be throwing the book at people left and right. He issued over $6 billion in fines during his tenure during the Biden administration against the cryptocurrency industry. Anytime a company would come into the SEC to make a good faith effort to say, hey, what do we need to do? Bam, they get hit with a fine. They get hit with litigation. So now that we have a crypto-friendly SEC chairman and we have this clarity, it hasn't actually passed yet. It's going to have to go through the Senate, but I think it's only a matter of time. It's gone through Congress. Trump is going to greenlight any crypto thing that falls on his desk. He's going to sign off on it. So that's a big deal because it classifies most crypto projects as commodities, which I think is probably more accurate, and puts them under the jurisdiction of the CFTC, which doesn't have such stringent requirements. I think that's common sense. It doesn't make any sense to me to have 100-year-old securities laws applied to blockchain projects. It's stupid, in my opinion. And the biggest thing, which has passed, it has gone through the Senate, as I predicted it would, and has been signed by Trump, is the Genius Act, which is all about stablecoins. And you're going to be hearing more and more about stablecoins as the years go on. And it's I think Treasury Secretary Bessent is hoping that implementing this policy on stablecoins is going to boost demand, particularly for short-term treasuries, which will bring the rates down and allow we're printing trillions of dollars a year. So anything they can do to get that interest rate down, even marginally, makes a big difference. And Bessent is not a dumb man, and he's realizing that this is a pretty strategic vehicle for doing that. Not only does it bring short-term rates down, but it will hopefully dramatically boost demand for U.S. dollars, because in this act, it's required. They have regular audits, and everything has to be backed one-to-one with dollars or treasury notes. So it is essentially just going to hopefully massively boost demand for dollars and short-term treasuries, which is going to strengthen the dollar. It's going to strengthen dollar dominance globally, and it's going to create a lot more international transactions, remittance payments, all sorts of payments globally. I think it could even open the door eventually to corporations issuing their own stable coins, which of course will have to be backed to the one-to-one to the U.S. dollar, but they'll have their own incentives that people will use. Like maybe there'll be an Amazon coin, maybe there'll be a Walmart coin, I don't know. But all of these things will serve to strengthen dollar dominance at a time. Just like this trade deal hoped to do, you've got the BRICS countries that are trying to break away from the U.S. dollar hegemony. They're trying to create a multipolar world. This is all an attempt to strengthen U.S. hegemony for good and bad. And what I think is good is keeping our reserve currency status going and keeping the dollar strong, because as you and I point out all the time here, Nick, the deficits we're running, the money printing that's going on has now spiraled to a level that's completely out of control, and nobody knows how long this thing can go. But this Genius Act, I think, is a step in the right direction to strengthening the U.S. dollar. And guess what? Most of that's happening on the Ethereum blockchain. So bullish on Ethereum.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason we have such a large defense budget. I'm convinced part of that is to keep us as the reserve currency, which, don't get me wrong, I thoroughly understand the benefits of that for myself, my family, and my children, despite the qualms I have with it. I want to talk more about stable coins, because I was discussing the Genius Act on this podcast 4 or 5 weeks ago in the same context that you just put it, i.e., creating demand for U.S. Treasuries to help subdue rates. I'm not even sure what my question is here. Maybe you can help me form it. But and Tether was then very much in the news. And interesting for me and Gerardo, what I started talking about was Tether also made an investment into a gold royalty company, and not even like a large gold royalty company, like not like Franco or Wheaton or anything like that. I mean, it bought Elemental Altus, a much smaller royalty company. Why would, on the back of your discussion there about the Genius Act and stable coins having to hold reserves and back their currency, why would a company like Tether be interested in, I think it was $80 million or $60 million they put into this, which is tiny, right, in the overall scheme of things. But why are they interested in a gold royalty company?
I think Tether has more money than they know what to do with, and they're just looking to put it into something that is kind of perceived as being kind of a safe bet or kind of a hard asset to kind of shore up their balance sheet and keep everything stable. But yeah, there are a lot of conspiracy theories that swirl around the internet about Tether, how they're basically printing the USDT out of thin air and buying Bitcoin with this fake money that then blows up the market cap artificially, causing a bubble. With this
Fed balance sheet expansion,
it's the exact same thing. But I'm hoping that with this Genius Act, because of the regulatory framework that'll come with it, if that's happening, I never really believed that was happening. Maybe to an extent, that will shore that up again. But as for why they would be buying that treasury company, I can only imagine is they've got more money than they know what to do with. So somebody thought it was a good idea to put it into that.
Yeah,
I know they're diversifying into a number of different things, because they're just sitting on piles of U.S. treasuries.
Yeah, I was going to drill down further on that royalty thing, but let me stay away from that, because I want to ask you more about stuff you know more about. I want to keep down this Tether angle. So, and this is just my own uninformedness. I know that's not a word, but so Tether is a company. Help the audience understand this, right? And they produce a coin called USDT, right? Mm-hmm. That's correct?
Correct.
And so there's companies behind these coins. I was asking you a couple of weeks ago about Ripple, and you were saying you can't invest in Ripple because it's private, but that's not what I meant. I meant XRP, of course, right?
Yeah.
So can you help me, first of all, and the audience as well, understand the difference between like Tether and USDT and Ripple and XRP? Is Tether investable? Is Ripple investable? Are you investing in their stable coins because you think they're a good company? Are you investing, because as I understand it, you're investing in their stable coins just because they're stable, they're flat, they're pegged one to one against something else. So where does the company come in that respect? And is that, I guess, as a follow-on, is that even a good question? Is that not a topic that's like discussed in the crypto world?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because that's kind of getting into the world of settlement and international payments. But yeah, Tether is a stable coin, which means that supposedly all of the coins are back one-to-one to the U.S. dollar or U.S. treasuries. And there's massive demand for them, because with stable coins, you can use those stable coins for any number of transactions internationally. I've used them a lot to facilitate cryptocurrency transactions. Say if I want to exchange dollars for some obscure cryptocurrency on like a decentralized exchange, I can't use dollars directly. I'd have to use a stable coin intermediary. That's where Tether would come into play. You can also hold them and stake them for a larger yield than you could get from regular U.S. Treasuries. The yields are usually higher that you're getting from them. In the case of Ripple Labs and XRP, the XRP was really created as a blockchain that was supposed to facilitate all manner of international payments, specifically interbank transfers. So it was kind of branded as the banker's coin. And people were buying it with the hopes that it would become like the international settlement layer for banks. Like every transaction made would require a certain number of XRP tokens and using their blockchain. They did have partnerships with a number of banks. And I don't know if that narrative played out the way that everyone was hoping. I did get well over 300% gains on XRP token, but that project was somewhat stymied by that Gary Gensler-led SEC that I mentioned earlier.
Lawsuit,
that was one of the first lawsuits they did, I believe, back in 2021, where they accused Ripple of offering unregistered securities offerings. That caused the price to plummet. I personally was buying during that time. I think it was about 24 cents at the time that I personally bought, and I think it was at $3.38 or something just a week or two ago. But yeah, that's kind of the case for Ripple. There are concerns about how much of the supply Ripple Labs owns. It's been estimated that it's over 50%, so it is quite centralized, and they can dump coins on the market and cause the price to go down quite a bit. And I still don't know how much those coins are going to get used for these international bank transfers, etc. But it does remain one of the largest market cap cryptos, and Ripple Labs as a whole is going to see a favorable regulatory climate under the Trump administration, particularly considering that I believe their CEO, Brad Garlinghouse, was a pretty big contributor to Trump's campaign, along with a lot of other crypto companies.
Yeah, I think there was a time we were talking about, and I don't recall entirely, but we were talking about there was only a couple of coins that were approved for those international settlements. I don't remember all the details, but I'm assuming that's what that relates to, XRP being one of them. And I know it has appreciated significantly in recent months, and I did see you sold it for gains. So well done on that, and congrats to readers of your crypto cycle. I want to stay on the companies. So I was just talking about companies that have stable coins or altcoins, Ripple Labs, Tether, for example. But there's another sort of, well, a couple other classes of what I would categorize as blockchain or blockchain adjacent companies. And I've been interested in, and I've been investing in these for a couple of years. In Foundational Profits, we owned and profited from the BLOK ETF, Block, which owns companies like Coinbase, companies like Mara, which I'm going to ask you about in a second, MSTR, of course, which is just Strategy now, I believe, and Beyond, which I've owned independently for a while as well, which has a stake in the T0 platform, as does ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange, which owns the New York Stock Exchange. And Beyond is now moving to get T0 to list or to otherwise unlock its value. I don't know if you've been following that at all, but my question here is about those other companies, and I didn't mention Circle. So, you know, as the momentum builds, as people get more familiar with crypto, as the ETFs get approved, as they're the fastest growing ETFs humanity has ever seen, there's been spillover into companies that are crypto and blockchain adjacent. People want to invest in them as well. Obviously, MicroStrategy and Mr. Saylor have been everywhere for a number of years now. You were just talking about settlements and BIS and international payments and things like that. And this recent IPO, Circle, CRCL, I believe is the ticker, came across my radar. And when I go to its website, I don't own it. I haven't recommended it. I've hardly done any research because I don't understand it. When I go to its website, you know, it tells me it's a payment platform, or it helps with international payments. And it's one of these websites that I feel like I could go to a number of them, whether it's, you know, Visa or Fiserv or any of these other sort of payment, you know, Square, PayPal, things like that. And it's hard for me to differentiate. So, and maybe you don't know the answer, but what is Circle, and are there any sort of, you know, related companies like that, blockchain sort of payment companies? And then I'll ask you more about mining companies like Mara.
Well, yeah, I mean, Circle is like Tether. It's a stablecoin issuer, except that it is US based and it is fully compliant with SEC regulations. It's not publicly traded. I believe they had an IPO back in early June. And I think that they have a lot of partnerships, and they're very much a part of this Genius Act. And the demand for these USDC coins is going to increase as this Genius Act gains a footing and you see more international payments happen. It's hard to say exactly. So USDC operates on at least two blockchains that I currently know of. Obviously, the first one was Ethereum, as I mentioned. You can also do USDC on Solana as well, and they have and are expanding to other blockchains. But I think it's perceived as a safer option than Tether because everything is transparent and above board. And with interest rates being relatively high, people are able to generate a pretty high yield on their USDC coin just simply for holding it. You can hold it even in your exchange account like Coinbase and get something like a 6% yield on your USDC for doing nothing. So yeah, it's a rabbit hole that you can go down pretty deep. But the shortest explanation is that Circle is the preeminent stablecoin issuer in the United States. And people, as evidenced by the stock price since IPO, people are betting on it expanding massively now that we have this Genius Act, now that we have stable coins being an official part of economic policy in the United States.
Okay. And then what about, we mentioned MicroStrategy already, but these companies have been doing pretty good as well. I mean, they've been taking out, I don't know if they've been taking out loans, but they've been selling convertible notes for sure. Yeah. To buy Bitcoin. Mara Digital or Mara Holdings now, I think it's called, just did something similar, raising $950 million. And I do own and recommend that company. But and they own many Bitcoin as well, in the case of Mara, that they mine themselves. And so do you look at these companies at all? Because when I read about Mara and I do deeper due diligence, I mean, they're getting into AI, they're getting into, you know, grid management in some respects. Oh, yeah. Because they use a lot of power. Do you look at these companies, and do you think these are good investments, and do you think they go up sort of like, you know, rising tide lifts all ships if we're having a crypto a bull market, or do you just sort of stay right in the cryptos?
Well, in my publication Digital Dispatch, I have and do hold crypto miners. Three of them specifically, one of which is up over 100% currently. And you're right. These miners both help to stabilize the grid, especially in places like Texas, where they've had problems. In the case of Marathon, the baseload power requirements for these Bitcoin miners are huge. It takes an increasingly large amount of power to mine all this Bitcoin. So under times of stress, when the grid can't satisfy the demand, these Bitcoin miners can then be paid by the local utilities to lower their power consumption, which stabilizes the grid and allows that increase in power consumption across the grid for other uses like air conditioning or heating, etc. And also what you're seeing with these Bitcoin miners is they have so much computational power, so much electricity, so much cooling, so many microprocessors that they're able to lend some of that excess computing power to for AI uses, which is bolstering their balance sheets, bolstering their revenue, and kind of giving people more to sink their teeth into when it comes to investing in these companies, because we're seeing that the Bitcoin miners that are branching out into AI are seeing larger returns than the ones that are simply focused on Bitcoin mining. But Bitcoin mining alone is an incredibly profitable endeavor. And Marathon, like you mentioned, owns, I believe, the most out of any Bitcoin miner at over 50,000 Bitcoins. So I like to invest in Bitcoin miners that have very large holdings of Bitcoin, because I think it shores them up in a major way, and it ensures that they're solvent. Worst case scenario, they can sell off some of their Bitcoin reserves if they ever fall on hard times or we get in a really bad bear market. And for that reason, along with others, I think Marathon is a solid investment in Bitcoin mining, and it's one that I hold in my portfolio.
Nice. Well, let's wrap up that section, I guess. I'll give you a shameless plug or two, and then we can get to the bizarro banter portion of this podcast through the end of the month, which is today. Obviously, we were running a special on Crypto Cycle, a third off. If you happen to see some of those, by all means, take advantage. Or if you see this in August, give Jimmy Mangle a call in customer experience and tell him I said that we'll honor that discounted price. And then you just mentioned Digital Dispatch and holding some crypto miners in there. You've been doing quite well in that publication as well. At the top of the podcast, I mentioned that U.S. indices were at record highs, including the NASDAQ, which has been doing really well. And I mean, tech companies are back between them and utilities. They've been what's driving the S&P's recovery since April. I think it was Meta and, I don't know the other company, but Meta definitely had earnings this week and just crushed it, was up like significantly in aftermarket trading after the numbers came out. I think they're generating more in quarterly revenue than the entire market cap of the largest gold miner in the world, Newmont. So tech is back, baby. And you've been closing wins some things that I'm interested in. So Oklo was one of them. That was and is a advanced nuclear reactor company, a small modular reactor company founded or co-founded by Sam Altman, the same gentleman behind ChatGPT, and in a very real way, the AI revolution. And then over 1,000% on Rocket Labs, which is a company we did a promotion about a month or two ago, telling people that space and satellites was going to be a good industry to invest in. And Rocket Labs is one of the leaders there. And space stocks, alongside tech stocks, alongside quantum computing stocks, alongside even meme stocks, are back in a very real way over the past couple of weeks. So check out Digital Dispatch, check out Crypto Cycle, and Chris will keep you informed and invested in those types of companies as a foreign object works its way across our solar system for only like the second or third time ever. I don't know if you've come across that story.
I did see that. We'll have to worry about aliens next, as if we don't have enough problems, I guess.
Well, right now we're worried about genes, specifically the ones that the Sydney Sweeney is wearing in American Eagle advertisements. And we did a really bizarro world social commentary the past couple of weeks. We had on Rudy Havenstein last week, and we laid into Epstein and those who continue to be involved in his circle on both sides of the aisle. And so we won't do too much on bizarro banter this week, but I'm hearing that it's the end of wokeness because we have a hot chick selling jeans, and it's being received well by I don't know, at least the internet community, and in a very real way, the investment community as well, because the ad is for American Eagle, and I think they've added $200 or $300 million in market cap since the ad came out. And I know you think about wokeness a little bit. You and I have talked about it on this podcast and off. I think it's part of the fourth turning, which I mention a lot. And I think that it's on its way out as millennials have families and raise kids and are worried about mortgage payments and tuition and raising good kids and not as much about virtue signaling and other pockets of the culture that you know, it used to be fun to talk about and discuss, but don't really apply to a large portion of the populace. And so, again, not really sure what my question is there, but I do recall a Bud Light ad a year or two ago that featured
Dylan a transgender person, I believe his name was,
and they. Oh, you have a better memory than I do. And they lost a significant amount of market cap that took them some time to recover. And so I don't know. Have you seen this at all? Have you seen the Sydney Sweeney ads or the debate?
I mean, I didn't even.
And I guess what?
Yeah. No, go ahead.
No, sorry. One more thing is, you know, there's factions of the online community that I think try to stir up this debate. You know, on both sides, right? And so the outcry is that I think the tagline of the campaign is something like, you know, Sydney Sweeney has good genes. And the outcry is that that's a dog whistle for eugenics and Nazism because she's a white woman. So, which is total fucking bullshit. Like it's a hot chicken genes, right? And so anyway, what are your thoughts?
It's multifaceted, I think. I think the one key point is that Sydney Sweeney is an Irish-American girl from Spokane. This is not someone who's like part of some kind of elite group of any kind, first and foremost. Secondly, something like this ad campaign wouldn't have been controversial at all when we were growing up. I mean, it's just like you said, it's a hot chick in jeans. There's nothing wrong with that. Some of it is the reality of the woke segment of our culture. These are often people that are quite frankly fat and ugly, and they hate beautiful people. And it's just fat. It's like the hot girl in high school, and then, you know, the fat, ugly girls hate on her. It's almost like a high school thing going on a little bit, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with being an attractive white woman and doing an ad campaign. But obviously, there's a large segment of the population that seems to be triggered by that for whatever reason. I was raised to judge people by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, but I guess that's just an old-fashioned idea. Because it's certainly not playing out in our society in 2025.
Yeah. A lot of ways to go with it. But, and also, you never know what's real. Like, you see these pictures all of a sudden in the past week, every, like, major celebrity and politician you can think of has been AI'd into this image, right? Like Trump modeling the jeans. I saw Mr. T modeling the jeans.
Yeah.
I've seen all kinds of people modeling the jeans in the same pose, but I've also seen ads that featured Beyonce with blonde hair modeling jeans for other retailers and hadn't seen any backlash around that. And then of particular interest to me was American Eagle's response to, and it's sad that there even has to be a response, but you'll see these headlines like Sydney Sweeney ad generates backlash or calls to cancel American Eagle or whatever it is. And American Eagle sort of responds by saying almost what you said, like, look, man, the internet's not reality. And even though there's some faction that might be upset, like we just have a picture of a girl in jeans and we're doing an ad campaign. So
yeah, it's not a big deal.
Exactly. I mean, that would sort of be my take on it. So I don't know if it's heralding the end of wokeness or not, but I do see cultural shifts, independent of MAGA and independent of the election of Trump, that are happening in the opposite direction they were for the past 5 years. And I think that's a good thing. I've mentioned in 1984 on this podcast a lot. I'm working my way through the book and I'm getting close to the end. And yeah, some of that stuff is just like doublethink, right? Like the concept in that book that you have to hold opposing ideas in your head. And that's one of the tactics they use to like confuse and control you. And I just think immediately about penises and vaginas, because it's very black and white. It's very X and Y. Like you don't have to hold conflicting thoughts in your head about it. And they just wrapped you up in circles over the past couple of years. So anyway, hopefully we can get away from this woke sort of debate, and things like this don't have to be an issue, and we can just enjoy Sydney Sweeney in her Canadian suit.
Yeah, I it's very exhausting, and I think most people are kind of tired of it.
Yes, sir. On to premium portfolio picks. I am Nick Hodge along with Chris Curl, and that was the 328th episode of Investing in Bizarro World. We'll catch you next week. See ya.